I'd like to welcome everybody today. Joining us here for our discussion of Were the Founders Themselves Originalists? I have the pleasure of introducing our moderator for the discussion, Judge William Pryor. Judge Pryor serves as the Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. He was appointed to the 11th Circuit in 2005. Prior to joining the bench, Judge Pryor was the Attorney General for the state of Alabama. He earned his B.A., magna cum laude, from Northeastern Louisiana University and his J.D., magna cum laude, from Tulane University School of Law. His early career included clerking for the Honorable Judge Minor Wisdom of the Fifth Circuit and working in private practice in Birmingham, Alabama. In addition to his service on the bench, the judge was also appointed as a commissioner on the United States Sentencing Commission in 2013 and was the active chair of the commission from 2017 to 2018. Judge Pryor also teaches classes at the Cumberland School of Law at Samford University and the University of Alabama Law School. Judge Pryor, it's an honor to have you with us here today. And with that, I'll turn things over to you to introduce our first panel and panelists.
Thank you. Were the founders themselves originalists? Although this topic has been the subject of renewed academic debate, for those of us who witnessed the revival of originalism as an interpretive theory in the 1980s, the latest conversation is nothing new. In fact, the history of originalism is inseparable from the criticism that has accompanied it. In 1985, then-Judge Robert Bork argued in an article that a judge should consider himself or herself bound by the original intentions of those who framed, proposed, and ratified the Constitution. By then, he had been arguing in favor of some form of originalism for more than a decade. By his own account, the issue of original intent had been a topic of fierce debate in the law schools for the past 30 years. And prophetically, Judge Bork wrote that the controversy shows no sign of subsiding. The same year, then Attorney General Ed Meese brought originalism into the mainstream in a speech before the American Bar Association. He used that speech to advocate for what he termed a jurisprudence of original intention. General Meese argued that the founders expected that the text of the document and the original intention of those who framed it would be the judicial standard in giving effect to the Constitution. And he explained that he was not suggesting that judges should depart from the literal import of the words in the Constitution. Instead, he argued, as Justice Story had argued 200 years earlier, that where the words admit of two senses, that sense is to be adopted which best harmonizes with the nature and objects, the scope and design of the instrument. The backlash against General Meese's speech was swift and fierce. At a law school a symposium a few months later, Justice William Brennan lambasted the jurisprudence of original intent as little more than arrogance cloaked as humility. He described the jurisprudence as one that would uphold constitutional claims only if they were within the specific contemplation of the framers. And he rejected this approach on the ground that it is arrogant to pretend that from our vantage, we can gauge accurately the intent of the framers on application of principle to specific contemporary questions. To be sure, earlier iterations of originalism had focused on the subjective understanding and expected application of the framers. But General Meese, in the speech to which Justice Brennan was responding, explicitly disavowed precisely that conception of original intent. And Judge Bork was emphatic that, quote, no intentionalist of any sophistication believed that judges may apply a constitutional provision only to circumstances specifically contemplated by the framers. Still, Justice Brennan's comments were a sign of what was to come. criticism of originalism premised on a misunderstanding or a minority view of originalism itself. Justice Brennan's criticism contained another now familiar feature of anti-originalist scholarship. Like many modern critics of originalism, Justice Brennan did not propose that we adopt a methodological approach that would be more faithful to the founding generation than originalism is. Instead, Justice Brennan advocated an approach that aligned with contemporary moral preferences. He argued that what mattered was what the words of the text mean in our time. And he opined that the Constitution required judges to strive toward the goal of human dignity, a goal, Justice Brennan explained, that will never cease to evolve. Of course, it was not the founders' conception of human dignity that Justice Brennan sought to advance, or even the conception held by most Americans. Justice Brennan was clear that it was a particular vision of human dignity that the Constitution should guarantee. For example, the justice used his lecture to argue that capital punishment was a violation of human dignity and therefore the Constitution, even though capital punishment was permitted at the founding, and even though, as he acknowledged, his was a view to which a majority of my fellow justices, not to mention a majority of my fellow countrymen, does not subscribe. I will leave it to the audience to decide then, as between Justice Brennan's own methodology and the methodology he condemned, which of the two is better described as arrogance cloaked as humility. Other early criticisms of originalism were more nuanced and, as relevant to tonight's discussion, challenged the notion that the framers believed that their intent was a valid interpretive strategy. In one important article, also published in 1985, Professor Jeff Powell reviewed a wealth of 18th and early 19th century sources and found that founding era Americans did use the term intent in the context of constitutional interpretation. But as he explained, the founding generation derived intent solely on the basis of the words of the law, not by investigating any other source of information about the lawgiver's purpose, such as legislative history. And he explained that the founders themselves expected that the Constitution, like any other legal document, would be interpreted in accord with its express language. Far from sounding the death knell for originalism, Powell's article helped give the interpretive theory new life and an even firmer historical basis. To be sure, the article was effective in proving that a methodology focused on subjective intent was ahistorical. But Powell's view that what mattered at the founding was the original public meaning was readily accepted by originalists, not least because originalists themselves had already begun to champion that view. In fact, less than a year later, then-Judge Antonin Scalia proposed changing the label from the doctrine of original intent to the doctrine of original meaning. He argued that original intent was misleading because what matters is not the original intent of the framers, but instead the most plausible meaning of the words of the Constitution to the society that adopted it, regardless of what the framers might secretly have intended. And he quoted from letters written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and President Washington to confirm Powell's thesis that the founders looked to the obvious and popular sense of the constitutional provision in question to determine the true meaning of that provision. Of course, that rebranded form of originalism, what we would today call original public meaning originalism, remains the predominant methodology among originalists. Later critics have attempted to build off Powell's work, but have similarly failed to undermine the historical validity of originalism. In his 1996 book, Original Meanings, Professor Jack Rakove marshaled materials from the late 1790s to show that there was sharp disagreement among the founders about the Constitution's meaning. And like Powell before him, Rakove argued that originalism was self-contradictory because the founders did not intend their intent to govern. But his research once again and confirmed that the founders did believe that the Constitution had a fixed meaning that could be ascertained from the text. Original public meaning originalism again emerged unscathed. We see echoes of these earlier debates in the modern debates about originalism's legitimacy. Consider the recent criticism levied by Professor Adrian Vermeule of self-described common good constitutionalists, or as I have called him, a living common goodist. Professor Vermeule levels the same kinds of criticism against originalism that failed almost 40 years ago. For one, he is adamant that, quote, the framers and ratifiers themselves were not originalists. But like Rakove and Powell before him, Vermeule seems to assume that mainstream originalism remains a theory of original subjective intent, a false assumption. Indeed, in his article and book about the common good, Vermeule relies on Powell's work to support the assertion that modern originalism is counter-originalist, perhaps unaware that Powell refuted original intent by establishing that the founders were originalists in the modern sense. Professor Vermeule's alternative to originalism is no different from Justice Brennan's preferred approach, except that Vermeule substitutes his political preferences for those of the late justice. To be sure, Professor Vermeule cloaks his preferences by describing them as flowing from the so-called classical tradition about the common good. But throughout his work, the phrase common good evades concrete application except where the outcomes happen to align with Vermeule's own worldview. Open borders, strict gun control, and the greenest of the Green New Deal. It is unclear to me what those issues have to do with the classical view of the common good. Perhaps one day Professor Vermeule will tweet the answer. In the meantime, here to discuss the views of the founders about originalism are two of the greatest originalist scholars of our time. A third is here on the front row. Professors Akhil Amar and John McGinnis. Akhil Amar is Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, where he teaches constitutional law at both the college and law school. Having joined the Yale faculty in 1985 at the age of 26, he is Yale's only currently active professor to have won the university's unofficial Triple Crown: the Sterling Chair for Scholarship, the Devane Medal for Teaching, and the Lamar Award for Alumni Service. Professor Amar is the author of more than 100 law review articles and several prize-winning books, and he has been cited by Supreme Court justices across the spectrum in more than 40 cases. No less distinguished is John McGinnis, the George C. Dix Professor in Constitutional Law at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. He too is a prolific author with innumerable articles about originalism in leading law reviews and a 2013 book entitled Originalism and the Good Constitution. Professor McGinnis is also a contributing editor of the website Law and Liberty, where he regularly weighs in on the modern debate about constitutional law. He is a past winner of the Paul Bator Award, now called the Joseph Story Award, by the Federalist Society to an outstanding academic under 40. Before moving into academia, Professor McGinnis was Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice and served as a law clerk to Judge Ken Starr of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He is a graduate of Harvard College, Balliol College, Oxford, and Harvard Law School. And one of the best times I ever had was 10 years ago last month, being his debate partner at the Oxford Union. Professor McGinnis will begin.
Well, thank you so much for that generous introduction, Judge Breyer, and thanks so much to the organizers for inviting me here. When the topic was proposed, I thought, well, maybe I would just get up and say yes and then sit down. But I thought one might say a bit more, because I think it is pretty clear the founding generation was broadly originalist in constitutional interpretation. As Judge Breyer has suggested, they thought the meaning of the Constitution was fixed at the time of enactment, and it wasn't subject to updating by interpretation. That was left to the amendment process, and originalism actually energizes the amendment process by allowing us to be framers. But what's harder to assess is what kind of originalists they were, and thus I want to argue today that they were legal, contextual, textual originalists rather than living constitutionalists. Now, you might think that legal, contextual, textual originalists seems like quite a mouthful. What it means is that first, the framers focused on the text rather than directly on the intent of the framers. And second, they were not word or even clause-bound textualists. They ascertained the meaning and often made it more precise by consulting both the entire document, by history, and by its legal background. The Constitution was not created ex nihilo, but against a rich background of Anglo-American history and Anglo-American interpretive methods. That was all to the advantage of the officials who had to implement the Constitution and those who lived under it, because that heritage can make meaning more exact than might otherwise be expressed within the four corners of a short document. In this brief time, I'll begin by looking at the document itself for inferences about the originalism of the founding generation. The Constitution they created is, in some ways, the essential context for its method of interpretation. Also say a word about the Anti-Federalists. Some of them, to be sure, opposed the methods of interpretation in favor of in favor of more populist than legal methods, but that doesn't mean that populism was to be expected to be used. To the contrary, their opposition to the originalist methods often came from their recognition that they'd be likely to be employed, and that was the reason they wanted them to be the Constitution to be rejected. I'll end by showing that an originalist interpretation of the founding generation in action. Obviously, in a short talk, I can't do justice to the huge variety of constitutional argument and debate in the early republic. Instead, based on work with Mike Rappaport, I focus on the debate over the constitutionality of the Bank of the United States to show that all the main participants in the debate were originalists and even largely agreed on the methods of interpretation, even as they disagreed on the question of whether chartering a national bank was constitutional. Indeed, I'd argue the better the lawyers and the more experienced the lawyers were, the more they tended to agree on the interpretive principles, if not the result. So let's begin with the Constitution itself, because, of course, that was the founders' greatest achievement. And it itself provides some clues about how it is to be interpreted. For instance, as Professor Chris Green has argued in some interesting new work, the Oath Clause is an oath to this Constitution. And some internal references, such as in the Constitution, the powers granted herein and the enumeration, suggest that this Constitution is listing things. And that's the kind of thing texts do. Moreover, Washington's transmittal letter talks of delivering the Constitution for ratification to the states. And what was the Constitution? Well, it was a text written on parchment. The Constitution also provides, I think, some clues for the relevant time the meaning of that text was fixed. Article 7's reference to the ratifying conventions and the Constitution's internal reference to the time of adoption of this Constitution suggests that the text of the Constitution was historically fixed when it was enacted. Another indication, I think, that the salience of text is the great care the framers took in perfecting the text. Let me give an example of this. The Committee on Detail and the Committee on Style of the Constitutional Convention made many changes to bring clarity to the Constitution. Everyone was watching the nuances, down to its punctuation, and here's an example. For instance, Gouverneur Morris, the most influential member of the Committee on Style, rendered Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, as providing three separate powers. One, to lay and collect taxes, duties, and imposts. Two, to pay debts to the United States. And three, to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Their separation was indicated by a semicolon. But Roger Sherman saw that breaking up the phrases with a semicolon would give greater powers than he thought had been the sense of the convention, and thus eliminated the last semicolon, making sure that the requirement to provide for the common defense and general welfare provided a limitation on the first two powers and not an expansion. Such careful reticulation suggests that both that the text was the essential matter for interpretation, they took a lot of time over it, and the text was designed to limit as well as empower the federal government. If one updates the Constitution, one destroys the delicate compromise that was forged in that text. The relevance of the entire Constitution to interpreting particular clauses is also suggested by the text, by its interlocking nature of many provisions, such as the Necessary and Proper Clause, and the repetition of words and concepts. Examples are officer and necessary. The intertextualism practice, and perhaps practiced most famously by my fellow panelists here, I think flows directly from the way the document is written. In short, as Justice Patterson noted in the 1790s, what differentiated the United States Constitution from previous national constitutions, like the British Constitution that preceded it, was its, quote, written exactitude. But the relevant context of the Constitution also comes from the fact that it's a legal document. As philosophers of language remind us, much of what's asserted in a proposition is contextual. And one important part of the general context of the Constitution is its legal context. That comes from the fact that the Constitution was clearly understood as law. As a result, the Constitution's words must be understood against their common law and other aspects of legal background, interpreted according to the rules of interpretation generally applicable to legal documents, with the caveat that some of the rules need to be changed to apply to the Constitution or modified. There are many ways we know that the Constitution makes clear it's a legal document. First, the Supremacy Clause defines itself as the supreme law of the land. The Constitution defines itself. Second, the Constitution is full of legal terms. It's extremely difficult to account for the plethora of legal terms without understanding the Constitution is a legal document to be interpreted, at least when it's relevant, against the background of the law at the time. There are so many legal terms that Mike Rappaport and I have saved you the trouble by counting them all. Some terms, like letters of marque and reprisal, are unambiguously legal. No one would understand them in ordinary language. Others have a legal meaning, although perhaps also an ordinary meaning, as well, something like privileges and immunities of citizens of the several states. Altogether, such terms appear 103 times in the short document of the Constitution. More appear in the Bill of Rights, like the term due process. The first Congress's decision to write down the people's rights in the language of the law confirms that the founding generation understood the Constitution as written in that language, and is to be interpreted when relevant, according to the legal conventions of the time. To be sure, that doesn't mean that every word or clause in the Constitution needs a legal context to unpack. Legal rules themselves recognize that many contexts in which ordinary meanings predominate. Moreover, another indication the Constitution was interpreted against the background of legal rules is that it contains specific clauses that block the application of legal interpretive rules that would otherwise apply. For instance, after stating that the Constitution and other federal laws are the supreme law of the land, the clause provides this phrase, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Professor Caleb Nelson of this very law school explained the reason for the appearance of what might seem a curious phrase, that it actually has a well-understood meaning in the law at the time. It's called a non obstante clause. It was to block the application of another legal interpretive rule that would require judges to harmonize state and federal laws, even if the best reading of the state law were such that it should be blocked under the Supremacy Clause. The provisions show the Constitution was understood against a set of relevant legal backdrops, again, when those are relevant. And early observers of the Constitution recognized that it was a document that needed to be interpreted as such. For instance, St. George Tucker wrote, "Legal science only is equal to the task of making sense of the complexity of our system of constitutional government." And one way the Federalists assures the Anti-Federalists they would not twist the Constitution to create a stronger federal government than was contemplated by the Constitution was to point to textual interpretation done according to legal rules. That was the response of Hamilton to the Anti-Federalist Brutus. According to Federalist 78, judges would just compare the statutes to the Constitution, voiding them only if they conflicted. In doing so, they'd be bound down by, quote, strict rules and precedent, in Hamilton's words. Thus, Hamilton relies on the nature of the Constitution, the contextual nature of the Constitution in its legal context as a protection against updating. More evidence, I think, that the legal rules expected to be applied do not support living constitutionalism. Now, let me move to show how the founding generation employed originalism. I think the debate over whether the federal government had the power to charter a bank happened immediately after the Constitution was enacted, is one of the best sources for how the founding generation regarded interpretation. This debate engaged a huge spectrum of political opinion. It pitted nationalists, who saw the bank as essential to sustaining a flourishing republic, against those more interested in preserving state power, which they saw as closer to the people and less liable to corruption than national institutions like the bank. The nationalists argued that the bank was necessary and proper to a variety of enumerated powers, such as the taxing power, and was clearly sustained by the text of the Constitution. Those who were in favor of more rights for the states were concerned that the necessary and proper clause should be interpreted, the nationalists were interpreting it too broadly. We were understanding it to mean conducive. They had a stricter meaning of what necessary, but again, a meaning rooted in the text. And they also made an argument that such a large power should have been expressly enumerated, which is a kind of textual argument about what the expectations of what kind of powers would be enumerated depend on how large they are. This debate sustained the attention of the most important political and legal thinkers of the time, from James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, and Edmund Randolph. So what comes out of that debate for the idea of are the framers originalists? Well, first, I think it comes that they were textualists who did not focus directly on the intent. And then in interpreting the text, they said we should follow the conventional rules of interpreting a text. Those involved in the debate largely interpreted the text according to rules that one would apply to documents analogous to the federal constitution, like a statute or state constitution. Famously, the bank was first debated in the cabinet. Secretary of Treasury Hamilton's opinion was the most explicit on the obligation to follow the text under established legal rules. He stated the intention of the Constitution is to be sought for in the instrument itself, of course, by which he meant the text, according to the usual and established rules of construction. But others in the debate also called for following the conventional rules of following the text under conventional rules. Elbridge Gerry, a bank proponent like Hamilton, but importantly for our discussion tonight, unlike him, an anti-federalist, argued the rules of Blackstone should be followed. Attorney General Edmund Randolph, an opponent of the bank, also discussed how conventional statutory rules of interpretation should apply to the text of the Constitution. None of them argued for anti-originalist rules or for judicial updating. Their views should be, I think, given great weight because they emanated from very able practicing lawyers. But even those who didn't make a living practicing law used conventional rules. Thomas Jefferson's opinion against the bank largely turned on the conventional anti-surplusage rule, as he argued that a large power of the bank, such a large power, would have to be enumerated. James Madison set out a series of interpretive rules that would lead to making a constitutional judgment against the bank. Again, though, rules are about the text of the Constitution. There's one way, I think, in which his proposed rules weren't quite like the others embraced. He appeared to think the Constitution should be interpreted like a treaty, but that view didn't seem to be widely shared even by those who agreed with his opinion that the bank was unconstitutional. Importantly, there appeared to be a consensus against the direct use of substantive intent of the Philadelphia Convention, against the idea of the originalism of original intent. Well, Hamilton and Randolph, I think the two best practicing lawyers among the disputants, disagreed on whether the Bank of the United States was constitutional. They agreed that the intent of the framers was not relevant. Madison mentioned his memory of what happened at the convention in his speech on the bank, but even he didn't include it in his reference to the five relevant legal interpretive rules of the text for his legal analysis. Jefferson did argue the framers had implicitly rejected a bank based on what they intended at the convention, but the anti-surplusage rule was more important even to his legal analysis. To be sure, the intent of the framers was sought indirectly by interpreting the text, but not independently. And I think that's very consistent with much of the rest of what we see in the founding era. Chief Justice Marshall famously argues that the intent of the Constitution is chiefly collected from its words. It's the text that is paramount. The debate over the bank also does not support the notion that it was a conventional rule to directly consider the substantive intent of the participants at the state conventions as constitutive of the meaning of the Constitution any more than the framers' intent. But it's quite interesting how some of the disputants used that intent. Instead, they suggest that the material from the ratifying conventions may have had an interpretive role, but a limited role. Thus, they didn't look at them as a matter of intent. They used the state conventions as a form of evidence about the interpretation of a text laid down by others. In other words, the convention was the first interpreters of the text. And they only looked at the formal actions of an entire convention, like the passage of proposed amendments as to what it thought the Constitution meant, not individual comments of the ratifiers. This, too, was an application of a conventional legal rule. Contemporary expositions of statutes by officials had long been given weight in Anglo-American law. But note that it was applied in a new context. They were giving a weight to contemporary expositions, in this case, by the ratifiers of a document that had already been laid down. The most important lesson to take away from the bank debate among opponents and advocates is how I think originalists they were. When they debated the meaning of a text, they debated as if the meaning were already fixed and something to be clarified through resort to conventional rules of interpretation. They were thus acting self-consciously as interpreters of a written text. The famous opinion in McCulloch versus Maryland upholding the bank is very familiar to many of you, and I won't analyze it here, other than to say it follows, I think, a kind of contextual textualism that considers the meaning of clauses in the context of the whole document, looking at words and connecting to other words, and to note also that it begins by expressly relying on the arguments of the cabinet members and the members of Congress in favor of the bank. But it's important to rebut one argument from the opinion that has been used to justify living constitutionalism. And I think this is an argument that I dare say some of you may even have heard from one of your professors. Namely, the argument is from the language that the Constitution is, quote, designed to endure, that it must be adapted to crisis in human affairs. And that suggests that the Constitution is a living document, was it's designed to endure and has to be adapted to crises in human affairs. I want to end by giving what I think is a full refutation of that, because I think it is the single most common argument that the founders were living constitutionalists. Consider a fuller context of Marshall's discussion. Here I quote from McCulloch. The subject is the execution of those great powers on which the welfare of a nation essentially depends. This could not be done by confiding the choice of means to such narrow limits as not to leave it the power of Congress to adopt any which might be appropriate and which is conducive to the end. This provision is made in the Constitution intended to endure for ages to come and consequently to be adapted to the various crises of human affairs. To prescribe the means by which government should in all future time execute its powers would have been to change entirely the character of the instrument and give it properties of a legal code. While Marshall certainly recognizes here the problems of allowing future decision makers to respond to new circumstances, his argument is not that the Constitution should be adapted to mean whatever those future decision makers believe it should mean. Instead, he argues that the problem of anticipating future circumstances requires that Congress be given broad authority so it can choose among the means. Moreover, even if one were to interpret the language as allowing Congress to adapt the Constitution to future circumstances, It does so only in a relatively narrow way. Congress might have the power to adapt the means to future circumstances, but it clearly does not have the power to change the meaning of the ends. While Congress can select new means to regulate commerce among the states, for instance, it cannot change the meaning of the term regulating commerce among the states. The interpretation of Marshall's opinions as embracing a broad but originally defined meaning of Congress's powers also has the advantage of rendering the decision consistent with his other opinions. Marshall's discussion of both constitutional and statutory interpretation in such cases as Sturgis versus Crowingshield read like textual originalism. There he said that the meaning of the text should be rejected only if it reached absurd results, and that absurdity, here I quote him, would have to be so monstrous that all mankind would, without hesitation, unite in rejecting the application. And even this absurdity rule is another example of a legal rule that's applied at the time. So I think it would be incongruous to think of McCulloch as voicing a different view than textualism that he practices in the opinion. It's also significant that the view that McCulloch endorsed living constitutionalism, which is widely put about today, wasn't followed by courts for centuries. During the 19th century, the quote was never cited to support the view that the meaning of the Constitution would change over time. Thus, the originalist interpretation that those in the early era practiced was so powerful that it continued to dominate constitutional law for decades, even if on occasion it was misapplied. It began to fray later in the 19th century, and in the progressive era, an alternate vision of the living Constitution came to the fore. But today, the court appears to be moving back towards an expressly originalist interpretation of the Constitution. I've tried to show in this talk that in doing so, the court is reviving the interpretive practices of the founding generation and applying them anew. Thanks very much.
Professor Amar.
It's such an honor to be with you. My friend John McGinnis has said a lot of things that I originally was going to say, so I began crossing things off my list furiously. So I find myself in very great agreement with him. So let me try to elaborate on some of the things that he's already told you. So if we begin with just the simple, yes, the question for the of the hour is, were the founders themselves originalists? Yes. Now, and he told you that. Now, why were they originalist? What's the psychological and phenomenological background of all that? Here's the, first of all, what else would they be? Today, the most principled alternative to originalism would probably be a relentless focus on precedent, but they hadn't really established very many of their own precedents. They had English ones, I suppose, and so we're going to have to come back to that. Or I guess we could just be unprincipled pragmatists. You've already, we haven't mentioned Richard Posner, but I suppose we should. But who are these people that we call founders? They've done something, and they know they've done something that no one in the history of the world had ever done. They composed a terse text for themselves and their posterity to be governed under, and then they put it to a vote to an entire freaking continent. Nothing like that had ever happened before in human history. There had been very few self-governing societies in the history of the world, pre-Periclean Athens, pre-imperial Rome. The Brits have some self-governance. They've got jury trial, plus or minus, and elections, although very few people get to vote, and high property qualifications. But they got a king no one voted for, and a House of Lords no one voted for, but some self-government. But And then they're Swiss, but they have, frankly, more sheep than human beings. So that's the world. That's not just 1787, that's 1687 and 1587 and all the 87s back to recorded, you know, history. There's very little self-government in the world, but even those places that have self-government had never come up with written constitutions put to a vote, had never been democratically adopted by, to borrow a phrase, we the people, ever. They are aware of just how audacious and, yes, the word is exceptional, what they're doing. So of course, then having done it, and let me just tell you just a little bit more about what they did. In 8 of the 13, because Beard made you, because he mentioned the progressive historians, made you miss the basic story. This wasn't of, by, and for the 1%. It was put to a popular vote, and in some places, actually, it was voted down. Rhode Island and North Carolina, the fix was not in. It wasn't by, and for the 1%. Doesn't say we the property, doesn't do we the property. In 8 of the 13 states, ordinary property qualifications for ordinary elections were lowered or eliminated. Okay, in New York, and nowhere were they raised, in New York, all adult free male citizens get to vote on the Constitution. And those aren't the ordinary rules for New York, but no race tests, no literacy tests, no property qualifications, no religious qualifications. My God, this is epic. They are nothing less. And yes, let's just start with words, which talk about this Constitution. We, the people of the United States, do ordain and establish this Constitution. It's a text for the United States of America. And there's those words are so familiar to you that you forget what they are really saying and doing. It's a deed, it's an ordainment, it's an establishment. And and there's epic free speech. And you can oppose the thing, and no one puts you in prison. And no one dies politically in that entire year. Oh my God. I mean, I'm giving you the story of American exceptionalism because we're not being taught this in eighth grade anymore. Okay, and there are problems, and we can talk about slavery, and I'm going to, because I can't. But having done this, of course they're audaciously proud of it, and why would they just pay attention to a British system that they're building on, but also in part casting over. This is nothing less than the hinge of human history. The world will never be the same, they think. They're utterly audacious in that. As they look at the world, there's BC and AD. There's before the Constitution and after the document. Truthfully, I think they're right about that. There's very little democracy in the history of planet Earth before, and today over half the world by population landmass. And you are seeing right now that it matters whether you're a democracy or not when certain things are happening, and almost all the democracies on one side, I wish India were, it pains me that it's not, but you're seeing with distinctive moral clarity the difference between the old worlds of monarchs and militaries that they're trying to repudiate and a new world order that they're trying to bring into existence. So that's why they're originalists, because they're ridiculously proud of what they've done. And I say, rightly so. So I'm thinking today about Zelensky and our friends in Ukraine, and of course that makes me think of Churchill, who was not perfect, especially if you talk to any person from India, they will tell you, if you talk to my parents, who. But I think about Churchill, and he had all these bon mots, and he once, I think, said about Clement Attlee, that he was, he was a sheep in sheep's clothing, but he was also a modest man who had much to be modest about. And that might be true of other peoples, truthfully. Not to name names, but the Canadians. But Americans are an immodest people in important ways because we have much to be immodest about. That we're originalists because we did something epic, and now we want to contemplate what we actually really did, what we did agree to and didn't agree to. So that's why they're originalist. What else would they be? You know, having done this thing. Now, So I agree with my friend John McGinnis about the bank debate, which is very originalist, about the decision of 1789, which is very originalist. I think if you're at all skeptical of this, I do not affiliate myself with Jonathan Genap, who somehow thinks that they're postmodern or something. You know, maybe he could have gone to law school, because I think he would have written a different book if he had. I'm being straight with you, you see, because if I'm right, he's wrong. If he's right, I'm wrong. But if you doubt me, because I can't prove this, and he can't prove it in just a few minutes, I do think of an epically impressive constitutional scholar whom we haven't mentioned. I'm looking at my friend Michael McConnell. I'm thinking of the great days of the University of Chicago. Read David Curry's work on the Constitution in Congress, and you'll see that the debates, again and again and again, are originalist, and in the early cabinet, too, of course. Now, if I were giving one qualification, I would say, and this is on the fixity thesis, and they're different brands of originalism, and we can talk about them, and I'll just say a bit more about that. In addition to interpreting, they are implementing and to some extent actually making up a few things that are clarifying, liquidating is Caleb Nelson's idea, things that are slightly ambiguous. And I think you see that especially in regard to the executive power, because actually it's hard to do originalism with the executive branch, and Michael McConnell has written a wonderful book on the man who would not be king. That I commend to you all. The most distinctive thing about the Constitution is its presidency, because it's much less than a king and much more than a governor. So it's, okay, it's, you know, bigger than a bread box, but smaller than Montana, but exactly how much bigger and smaller. And the text doesn't tell you very much, and here's why. Because they were expecting Washington to be the first president, and he would actually help concretize, liquidate, settle the ambiguities with actually the country's acquiescence in the House, the Senate, and the other branches. So that's not pure interpretation quite. It might be construction, implementation, liquidation, and the like. But basically what he said. So what have I proved thus far? Not that much, just that it's not self-contradictory. Okay, so the founders, you know, believed in paying attention to the founders. Why should we? I've begun to give you some reasons, but I want to talk about later generations and whether they, I know that's not the topic, but I have still, I think, a few minutes left. So what about the best? Because why do we care about the founders? In part because they are what we have in common as Americans, but they're not the only things that we have in common. And see, we don't have that many things in common as Americans. We don't have race, we don't have ethnicity, we don't have religion. Some of us, our families came here last year, and some of us hundreds of centuries ago, and some of our ancestors came with bullwhips in their hands and some in chains. So we actually have a common story and a common set of institutions and a common tradition, yes. But originalists aren't just about tradition. They're about a text that actually does unite us, that creates institutions that have been, in general, faithful to the text, I would say. So what about later generations? And the best of later generations, were they originalists? That's actually a more interesting point. So we talk about John Marshall. John Marshall was actually a founder himself. He argues for the Constitution of Virginia. Virginia passes by this much. So yes, he is originalist, but maybe you think he's a founder. And you're right about McCulloch. The way I put it is, yeah, people are taught McCulloch is some living constitutional. He believes in evolution. He does not believe in evolution. Charles Darwin has not yet written, you know, The Origin of Species, The Voyage of the Beagle. You know, John Marshall thinks the animals entered the ark two by two. And so what he really means is, by adapting all the rest, the Constitution's powers are always going to be flexible, because a snake has a flexible vertebrae. A jellyfish is adaptable. It's not that it evolves, it's that it has, from the beginning, a built-in flexibility to it. That's what he's actually saying. Because he's not a 20th century progressive Darwinian. And by the way, so I want to tell you, because Darwin is one of the great figures of the 19th century. He's born on February 12th, 1809, but there's another person born on that day too. His name is Abraham Lincoln, you see. Maybe two greatest figures of the 20th century, born the same day. So was Abraham Lincoln an originalist? Damn straight. Okay? And that's a different generation. And he had reverence for the project. And he's an epically good originalist lawyer. And the Constitution doesn't always mean what he'd like it to mean. He doesn't love the Fugitive Slave Clause, but he will enforce it because it is law. And before him, let's talk about Joseph Story. He's kind of halfway in between, but the greatest constitutionalist really of his era. And that's why the Federalist Society has a prize in his honor, and rightly so. And yes, he's an originalist, and Lincoln is standing on his shoulders too. And have our best judges in later generations been originalists? I would say yes. The first Justice Harlan at his best moments, Hugo Black. The Warren Court at its best was an originalist court because it really does say freedom of speech, even if we weren't doing that. And it really does say that actually, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or means of the United States, which is at its core, paradigmatically, easily, and obviously, incorporation of the Bill of Rights against the states, and the Warren Court did that, even though precedent didn't say that, you see. And it really does say the right to vote five different times in the document, 14-2, 15-1, 19th Amendment, 24th, 26th, and the Warren Court at its best, John Ely understood this, Doug Laycock understood this, took seriously, Powell versus McCormick is a great originalist opinion by Earl Warren. So at the judges at their best have actually been originalist. Okay, 14 minutes. But what he said finally, what kind of originalists do you want to be? Because they're different flavors. I'll tell you my flavor and why I'm an originalist. I'm originalist because Constitution is law, okay, and that is this Constitution, because it's ours, so it doesn't quite bind the people of Canada or India, but it's also wise, because it involved a lot of people over a lot of years doing epically impressive things. So even if I am an Indian or Canadian, I might want to study it. I might want to be originalist of a certain sort, because I can learn from the greatest democracy the greatest self-governing society in the world since Rome. So here's why I'm not a Scalia-type originalist, because I think he looked at it too much from his own little point of view, whereas, of course, I'm giving you the view from God. So, you know, just above time and space, just sort of hovering and just communing with the eternal sphere. But he tended to focus on only judges, and originalism isn't. It's not a theory of judging. It's a theory of constitutional meaning. It's a theory of law. He tended to focus on restraint, but originalism doesn't just restrain, it actually empowers. He tended to focus on rules because he was into rules, but the Constitution isn't just, he was. The Constitution isn't just about rules, it's about principles and standards. He was into words, he was a snoot. But the Constitution isn't just about words, it's about larger systems of patterns of meaning and institution. He focused too much on the founding, and the Constitution isn't just originalist, can't just be about the founding. It's an intergenerational project because the Constitution failed because of slavery, you see. And so we have to take seriously the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, Lincoln's generation. And that's a very difficult project, trying to figure out, like, for example, how much of the Bill of Rights actually sensibly applies against the states, given that the Reconstruction vision has a different understanding to some extent of rights than did the Founders' vision. And how much do the 20th century amendments require us to reinterpret earlier texts? Those are the serious challenges of originalism. My version of originalism is holistic, as was Marshall's, intergenerational, as was Hugo Black's, and then finally, not result-oriented, since my friend Judge Pryor mentioned he who shall not be named, my friend Adrian Vermeule. Oh, I just named him, oops. So if I'm gonna have credibility with you all, and it's such an honor to be with you, you know, as your token liberal, as your devil's advocate, I'm going to tell you, here are things that are pretty important in the world where my political views are pretty different than my originalist views. I'm pro-choice, and I think Roe versus Wade is an embarrassment. I don't love the death penalty at all for personal religious reasons, and yet in all sorts of situations it's constitutional, including, I think, I haven't read the opinion today, but probably the opinion that just came down today, where I personally don't own a gun. Never have. They scare me. But you have a right to have a gun in your home for self-protection, and that's not so much just because of the Second Amendment, which Justice Scalia actually didn't interpret, in my view, that compellingly in Heller, but overwhelmingly because of the 14th Amendment, because actually the people who adopted the 14th Amendment had an idea, not just of militias, but of individual gun ownership in the home, because African Americans needed to have guns in their homes for self-protection because they couldn't count on the local constabulary when the Klan came calling. And that's taking original Second Amendment that's military and reading it as civilian, that's collective and reading it as individualistic, that was very state rights oriented and reading a more nationalistic way, because it actually limits the federal government as well as the states, that was very public and reading in a more private way. So that's actually a real challenge, an intergenerational challenge. Try to think about how the Second Amendment was re-envisioned, or the right to keep and bear arms, after Reconstruction. But I've given you three pretty hot-button social issues right now: guns abortion. And capital punishment, where my personal views are not the same as my constitutional views, because the Constitution is about us. It's about we, the people, and what we have in common. And if we don't cleave to it, my friends, what else, you know, do we have that will actually bind us as Americans? So that's partly why the framers were originalists, but it's partly why we should all today be originalists. Thank you very much.
So Professor McGinnis, Professor Amar asked an important question. That is, why should it matter to us if the founders were originalists? You made a compelling, exhaustive case that they were originalists, but why should it matter to us?
I think it matters to us because the kinds of why I think we should follow the Constitution, really, as Professor Amar suggests, has a lot to do with the fact of the way it was created. That was created by a large popular, Mike and I argue, supermajoritarian process, and that's what was really gives it a kind of dignity and likely beneficence. Well, of course, what got the votes was dependent on the expectations of how it would be interpreted. So if the founders actually were people who thought this document was just a group of recommendations, well, that makes it a little harder to say that we should be originalists today. Because after all, we just gotten through saying, well, what a wonderful it's in some sense law for us because of the excellent process it went through, and if actually they thought that they were just delegating it to the future, then we might think maybe we should follow that as well. We should have a kind of judicial updating. So it's important to understand their interpretive principles precisely because it's from there. It's the powerful process which they created the Constitution, I think, makes it quite plausible that we should follow it today. And the way they were going to interpret it is bound up into that. I mean, one way of thinking about it is this, is they wrote a text, but of course, as Professor Morris pointed out, some of it might be ambiguous, how did they even think about addressing those ambiguities? That becomes very relevant to us. Is that just a license to then update the Constitution? If that's true, it suggests that actually this tremendously powerful Constitution making may be behind, maybe sympathetic to some kinds of updating. But I think we see that it's not, that they actually thought the text was paramount. And that means that precisely, and I think Professor Amar is absolutely right, why we should be originalists today we need another premise. We need another premise. It doesn't follow that we should be originalists just because the framers were originalists. That would be circular. But I think once we decide that we should, why we should follow this document, has something to do with the way it was created and its likely beneficence, it becomes very relevant the way they interpreted the document, because after all, the way they interpreted the document had something to do with what we got the tremendous support for it. If someone had said it was to be interpreted in some other way, it might or might not have gotten that support. So that's how I think it's integrally related to the reason we should be originalists today.
Professor Amar, you mentioned the unprecedented nature of the Constitution, a written document put to a vote of an entire continent. But as you know well, one of the criticisms often levied against the Constitution is how many were excluded from that adoption. Does that discredit originalism or the Constitution?
It's why we have to go beyond the founding and be intergenerational. So, of course, if the founders weren't originalist, okay, John is right. So it's merely circular to say we should be we should follow the founders because the founders followed the founders or something. So it might be circular. But if they didn't, if they weren't originalist, it would be self-contradictory in a certain respect. And it's not that, okay? So fine, it's not. That's good, it's not self-contradictory. But so if you look at 1787 from the perspective of today, it's pathetic. Women didn't vote. There were property qualifications in some places, even for the Constitution's vote, although not in New York and not in several of the states. But there were. There was, of course, slavery. So if you look at it from the point of view of 2022, it looks not so good. But if you look at it from the point of view of 1786 and the history of the world before that, you know, more people were being allowed to vote than had ever been allowed to vote on anything in human history, and women didn't vote in Periclean Athens or in Rome or Britain. But now that's why the amendments turn out to be so important. It's not just that they put a lot of thought into the Constitution, so much that they actually then adopted a whole set of amendments thereafter, because they didn't think that you could just, you know, disregard the text, but they actually gave a lot of thought to the immediate amendments. But then later generations, just the amount of careful thought that went in my view, to the words of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which we were debating at an earlier event today, some of us. How much energy people today are putting in, for example, to ERA, that's because we actually think that the words actually mean something. So I'm a big fan of David Curry's. I'm less of David Strauss's when he writes that the amendments are irrelevant. It's an article that he writes in the Harvard Law Review, The Irrelevance of Constitutional Amendments. Well, what mass delusion has captured, you know, Americans generation after generation, like lemmings or something? Why the hell are you doing, we're trying to get ERA or anything else through if it's all bullshit? You know, if interpreters pay no attention to what you were trying to do and why, and what you weren't trying to do and why. Okay, again, forget all the flavors of originalism, original meaning, original methods, original intent, all of that stuff, but just big picture, you know, people are trying to do things for, and here's what they're doing. They're trying to actually make amends for those flaws at the founding, okay? That's what amendments do, in part, is make amends, because actually, the exclusions are grotesque in the eyes of later generations, and that's why. But the amendments need to be part of the story as well. It's not part of technically, you know, the narrow formulation of our question today. But of course, if the bigger one is why should we be originalists, you have to think about the amendments. And even as epic an amendment as the 19th Amendment, you see, which is a doubling of the franchise, you know, woman's suffrage. I mean, it's spectacular. But here, this is a challenge for originalists of a certain sort. women aren't full and equal participants in the vote on whether women are voting. See, because if they already had the vote, then they wouldn't need the night everywhere. They wouldn't need that ninth amendment. And they're voting some places, but not others. So even as epic an amendment as the 19th has a little bit of a process problem to it, because the instant that the 19th Amendment is ratified, to a certain extent, it calls into question ever so much, a little bit, the fairness of the process that led to it, in a way that wasn't, I think, to it the founding. So, you know, my kids are, you know, asking at age 15 why they can't vote, and, you know, and I tell them some story about why, and then, you know, when they turn 18, you know, I say, well, you can vote now because you actually, you know, are competent in a way that you weren't at 15. Well, it's not as if women sometimes say, ah, you know, yesterday we were nitwits, but today actually, you know, now that the 19th Amendment is adopted, oh my God, the, you know, the dove of heaven has landed on our shoulders, and now we're enlightened. The amendments have to be taken into account, and it is complicated, and you're a morally serious person, so you're asking a morally serious question that we all have to ask. But if you're not an originalist, what's your alternative, and is it better than really taking seriously what the American people have done, I would say, at our best moments? We've had very few bad amendments. They've added to liberty and equality and the march of democracy, added the right to vote, you know, five different times. So prohibition, not so great, but it was repealed. But very few other amendments have actually restricted liberty and equality. So the amendments have to, I think, in the end, be part of the story as well. And I'll say one other thing. If the alternative is the judges in their infinite wisdom, the eminences, I will take the people at our best moments, process certain ways, over five of the nine, you know, at any given moment, in June, you know, because I know who these law clerks are, and they're not even always my A-plus students. Just saying.
When did they reinstate grades at Yale Law School? Yes. I was actually going to ask you a question about the amendment.
But please, go ahead.
So Professor Amar has been making the case for the Constitution as an intergenerational document that has to be read in whole, mm-hmm. and over the time, mm-hmm. for all the amendments. Mm-hmm. You've made the case that the interpretive rules for the Constitution should be identified using the interpretive rules of the founders. Do those rules change with every amendment?
They could change, right? It would depend on the time. So, well, one point is the great second founding, the 14th Amendment. It's not obvious to me that the rules are all the same at that time. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think there's a lot of research project to be done on that. But if I could add just one other point about the amendments, because I think it's just so important to understand how connected the amendments are to originalism. I think Professor Amar has said correctly that, well, if we aren't originalists, why are people going to put in the amendments? And actually, so non-originalism, so one reason we may not have so many amendments in a non-originalist period is once we have non-originalism, why bother to put in any amendments? It's like giving another blank check to the court. But moreover, the reason is that if the court starts to think, well, we think we know what to do, we're going to update the Constitution, we may take the wind out of the sails of the amendment. And that may actually be a story about what happened with the ERA to some extent. Both of those things may have happened, that the court went a little bit. And so people said, well, the ERA isn't necessary, and at least at the end of the Warren Court, I think it's hard to say that it was a wholly originalist court. People say, well, why give another blank check to this court? So there's an absolutely crucial connection to, as we talk about why to be originalist. It's very hard to argue that we should be originalist if there were no amendment process, because the world does change. It's very hard to argue that. It's also hard, if we're really serious about the amendment process, not to be originalists. They are intimately connected to one another, and we march under one banner, I think, as Professor Amar suggested. Here we the people can be the framers again. Here we the people rule, not we the judges. So that is one thing that's very important to understand, that there's an absolute connection between the concept of amending the Constitution and the beneficence and the attractiveness of originalism.
So I started with pointing to the oldness of the debate about whether the founders were originalists. And critics of originalism sometimes say the founders were not. I know you both.
Right, and that would be the self-contradiction problem.
Right, that you both disagree with that. To what extent do you think those critics believe that they make the assertion in good faith?
So you mentioned, it was a trip personally down memory lane for me because you mentioned Robert Bork, and he was my teacher in a class that Steve Calabresi took with me. We bonded in that class, and we actually co-teach a version of that class to this day at Yale Law School. You mentioned Jeff Powell. Jeff Powell actually was a student at the time working on that project. So I do think that sometimes certain folks, they seem contradictory to me when they say, well, we can't know what the founders thought at all, and I know that they weren't originalists. Justice Brennan sometimes says stuff like that, and that he was a smart fellow. Professor McConnell clerked for him, but and maybe, you know, that was a law clerk that helped him with that rather than, you know, the justice. Not Professor McConnell, but
always blaming the law clerks.
So I think Jeff Powell's piece is really significant and very much in good faith and has been widely misunderstood, I think, for the reasons you identify.
Yeah, what about you?
I don't want to cast aspersions on the good faith of my colleagues. I don't have to go back and teach with them. But I think...
Well, I don't want you to identify any by name. Just to what extent do you think the assertion's made in good faith? I think the Jeff Powell example is a good faith assertion that improved the argument for originalism.
So here's what I would say. I would say that some evidence that at least some of them have not been in such good faith is that people, and I think it's one of the best developments that's actually happened, is that a whole group of people now are not writing these articles that originalism is ridiculous, but are actually getting their hands dirty and are becoming originalists and making arguments that are contrary to what conservatives have thought about originalists. That is the single best development that has happened in the legal academy, right? It's not a surprise that conservatives weren't very happy with some aspects of the Warren Court and thought that the original Constitution was probably not a Pandora's box of progressivism. That's probably not a surprise that they thought that. But they changed the debate, and then people, the beginning of the debate was, well, you're just ridiculous, originalism is absurd. But for whatever reason, and maybe it's because now there are six justices who are originalists on the court, but for whatever, or it's the power of, I'd like to think it's the power of arguments of people like me and Professor Amar, but for whatever reason, I think that's not what's going on in the left of the academy today, or at least much of it. Much of it actually in constitutional law, at least the part that I have seen, is actually very interesting arguments about non-delegation, all sorts of things that actually perhaps conservatives were taking too for granted some of the arguments. And it's always good to have people of actually different priors coming to...
So to speak.
P-R-I-O-R, right?
Coming to empirical evidence, and they're obviously going to look at it differently, but we're going to much more likely to get the truth when that happens. So I think that's just a wonderful development that there are now a whole group of liberal originalists. So rather than focusing on the bad faith of the past liberals, I'm hoping to hope for the good faith of the current liberals in engaging in the originalist project.
Well, let's pay some tribute to Justice Scalia in a way that I think you would agree with, and that is the power of his argument for originalism was at least good enough to command a supermajority of the Supreme Court to do something a lot like a Warren-era court in its interpretation of the Confrontation Clause, right, and Crawford.
So I think Robert Bork, who was my teacher, and Anton Scalia did, and they were, I was there when the Federalist Society was founded. It was the first annual. And Americans, we're such an optimistic people. We announced the first annual as if there's going to be like a second annual and a third annual. But I was there, and of course Scalia was one of the intellectual godparents of the society, and Ralph Winter and Robert Bork. And to be a serious originalist, you need to know a lot of history. And Bork actually didn't know very much, and Scalia, frankly, didn't know very much. It wasn't his love. His love was words, which is different than history. So he tried to turn it into a dictionary game, which I think is not originalism. Well done. That said, Bork and Scalia dramatically changed the conversation. Scalia especially changed even the judicial conversation dramatically in statutory interpretation, which has become more textualist and less legislative history focused. But yeah, they inspired someone like me to take this stuff seriously, maybe just to disprove some of their conclusions. So, and yes, what conservative originalists like some of you should be desperately hoping for is to have actually not conservative non-originalists, but liberal originalists. That's actually that whom you should. So Scalia and Bork, even if they didn't do it, and they didn't truthfully do it so much, I think they did help inspire another generation, because it requires a lot of historical work. On confrontation, Scalia didn't say it first in Crawford. The person who said it first was Thomas, based on oral argument in something that I think is first or second month on the court. He was beginning to see that there was a different way of taking seriously the words of the Confrontation Clause. I believe that organizations like the Federalist Society should give Justice Thomas more credit than you, because. And I met him first here in Charlottesville at a Federalist Society conference way back when, before he was on the court, I believe, when he was at EEOC, because I don't always agree with him. You don't always even agree with me. Okay, so I'm that disagreeable. But Justice Thomas is, I think, trying to live out his creed, because he's actually in the Hugo Black tradition reading. You can't actually be an originalist unless you read a lot of history, primary sources and secondary accounts. And I frankly don't think Scalia did that very much. I'm being honest with you. I don't think Bork did that very much. I think Thomas does that a lot. But Scalia and Bork made a Thomas, you know, or a McGinnis or an Akhil Amar or Steve Calabresi. They set the table for the next generation.
Oh, indeed. Any other thoughts? Should we open it up to some questions? Any questions from the audience? Yes, sir. Second row.
First of all, thank you to the panelists and to Judge Pryor. My question is, if one of the most significant reasons we should be originalists is because the framers were, should we still be originalists when we're interpreting an amendment that was adopted at a time when originalism was out of fashion? And if so, why?
Wow, that's a good one.
Well, I have to say, if indeed originalism was out of fashion at the time, one probably should not interpret it in an originalist way. But I don't think that's really true of most of the amendments. And of course, one has to look carefully at where one should look, because it's very hard to believe that many amendments were proposed with this idea that, well, we're really not meaning what we say, right? There's one, right. Law professors may write that, but one of the extraordinary facts, actually.
He means David Strauss.
Well, or one of your
We won't get into my colleagues. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually going to give an example from one of your colleagues.
Oh, my gosh.
Perhaps. So it's extraordinary when you watch law professors go and testify before Congress. They often sort of drop their very non-originalist theories. And one colleague, well, can I name him?
Please.
Bruce Ackerman had a very famous theory about NAFTA. He said, well, of course, and then the question here is whether NAFTA, which was not a treaty, does it have to be a treaty? And he said, well, by the original Constitution, man, it had to be a treaty. But actually, he has a theory that the Constitution is amended outside the amendment process, and they're in something called constitutional moments. When these constitutional moments come is hard to figure out, and there are many of them, and people have looked around for them, and I think there are now 34 or so constitutional moments. But, so there's a hearing about whether NAFTA is constitutional, and you might have thought, after being written an article, I think in the Harvard Law Review, saying it wasn't constitutional, but there was this constitutional moment in which it became constitutional, senators, and that's why it's constitutional. No. He didn't mention that at all. He made some rather weak argument about the Commerce Clause and its actual meaning. So I think there's...
You're not suggesting that law professors would say one thing in law review articles and something else to the elected representatives of the American people, are you?
One of my favorite pieces by Professor Ackerman is a piece on the taxing power. It's in the Columbia Law Review, and it's a very impressive piece of intergenerational originalism, in part because, yes, he was trying to get policymakers to take seriously a certain proposal, and so that's one of my favorite Ackerman pieces.
But let me just say that I think so, in looking at the actual rules that are applied, one just can't actually even look at judges. One actually has to look at how actual people work in Congress. Those are very relevant, of course, to figure out whether they were originalists, and I tend to think they're going to be originalists because there's a certain common sense nature to originalism that makes it unlikely that subsequent amendments, even when maybe academics have gone off the reservation and maybe even a few judges have, that those who are proposing the amendment, that the rules that they expect to be applied are not originalist. So I think it's a conceivable possibility, but I think very unlikely to happen in a world where we very happily have amendments that go through a popular process, not a judicial or academic one.
And here's one way of saying that. The people who are trying to amend are trying to do a certain thing, and they actually care about that. They're not trying to do other things, and they wouldn't be so amused if immediately after adoption, when they really had tried to do X and the judges immediately didn't do that and did something else, like they were trying to, for example, protect black people and fundamental human rights, and they ended up with rights of corporations or something. I'm just, saying Lochner era or something. So they might not be amused by that, but if they really weren't trying to entrench a certain vision as part of an enduring constitution, they could put a sunset clause in the amendment, and some amendments have actually had sunset clauses of certain sorts. And others haven't, but like the 1808 clause and all the rest. So I do think there is some internal evidence in the very drafting of the thing that suggests that people who are trying to amend the Constitution are trying to amend the Constitution in the constitutional way.
Right. Question, young lady.
Thank you all so much for this amazing discussion. It was so much fun listening to all of you. But I was just wondering, we tend to think of the framers, I think, as a group in a lot of ways. And at least in the way that we discuss them as the framers generally, and then kind of pick and choose Madison or Hamilton or whoever it may be to...
The answer is Hamilton.
To each their own, to prove our point.
I'm with Professor Amar.
But given that, and given that often sources like the Federalist Papers are cited as sort of authoritative originalist documents, for better or worse, whatever that is useful for, but on the other hand, we also have founders like Jefferson who suggested generational turnover in constitutional conventions and that sort of thing. And I guess the core of my question is, who should we pay attention to and why?
So here at Mr. Jefferson's university, I will tell you not Jefferson. And I will tell you why. And if you had asked me 40 years ago, if you'd met me in college, I would have said, oh, if I'm ever lucky enough to have a son, I'm going to name him Jefferson. And I will not say that now. Okay, so here's one thing. He wasn't here when it happened. Mm-hmm. Okay, and he missed much of the conversation, and he was Rip Van Winkle. So that's actually kind of important when he actually missed what really, you know, what the conversation, because I told you, this is the hinge of human history, and he was off drinking wine and chasing women in France, just saying. Okay, whereas John Marshall actually was freezing his butt off at Valley Forge. So if you have to pick, and they're second cousins, and I would say pick Marshall, okay? Second, because actually Jefferson I tell the life story of the six most significant framers. The big six are the first four presidents, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, plus Hamilton, and Franklin. The Constitution is fundamentally, so again, I'm saying this at the University of Virginia, I know who, you know, where I am, it is not James Madison's Constitution. The idea that he's the father of the Constitution is ridiculous. He's a nobody from nowhere in 1787 whose one contribution is getting George Washington to show up, who is picked as the unanimously the presiding officer of the convention. Five of the 55 people there were his law clerks, his aides de camp. Five of the 55 from five different states, Mifflin and Pinckney, Charles Pinckney, and Hamilton, and the other two will come to me in just a moment. So the preeminent thing about the document, Madison gets nothing, almost nothing that he distinctive that he really wants. Washington gets everything, most importantly, a very powerful presidency. His right hand is Hamilton. Madison turns against him and loses on all these issues like the bank. And here's the reason why. Just he's making originalist arguments, but then he flips and eventually signs the bank. And tells us what's going on? What's going on is the bank is unpopular in his home base, and he has to cater to his home base just like Kevin McCarthy does. But as soon as he's president of the United States, he actually stops doing that. If the arguments against the bank were perfect, and Jefferson says utterly idiotic things, Thomas Jefferson thinks that all banks are Ponzi schemes. He actually does. He doesn't understand finance, and that's why he dies, you know, in debt. And all his slaves are sold, and his slaves are sold on auction blocks. And you need to understand that he starts out admirable, and he ends up saying the Missouri Compromise, starts out saying we should end slavery in the territories, he's the author of an early version of the Northwest Ordinance, and will end with Madison saying prohibiting slavery in the territories is unconstitutional, which is going to be Dred Scott nonsense. Okay? They don't free their slaves at the end of their life. Washington does. So, yes, part of why you care? We care about these people because they actually are part. It's not just the word and the text. It's an American story. So you're going to have to decide who should be your heroes and why. And I've begun to tell you some reasons because Jefferson didn't understand the Constitution. It's Washington's Constitution. People voted for it because it's Washington. He's a unanimously elected president, unanimously reelected president, and his precedents define, actually, Article 2, like presidents can fire cabinet officers at will, decision of 1789, which is not so clear from the text, you see. So it's Washington's Constitution, start to finish. You know, and that's why, oh, McHenry was another one. I forgot. McHenry, Mifflin, Pinckney, Hamilton. This was bothering me. So if it's Washington's Constitution, that has implications for originalism. He thinks that cabinet officers answer to him, and that's definitive. And Jefferson, to repeat, wasn't even there, says one daft thing after another. Look, okay. McCulloch is unanimous. And five of the seven justices are appointed by Madison and Jefferson. And yet, see, Jefferson says the bank is unconstitutional. Silly. Okay? So you're going to have to decide who knows what they're talking about because they were there and who doesn't. Yes, but they're all making originalist arguments, just some are more persuasive.
Okay, a last word, but we've gone a little over our time. If you have a final word you want to say.
Well, I just think we have to be a little cautious about deciding who are heroes in interpreting the Constitution. After all, I began by saying we should be contextual textualists. We begin with the text. That isn't about any person. That's important to remember. The rule of law is about a text, not some particular group of people. And so it is absolutely true that we might dismiss some of Jefferson's understandings because he's away from the Constitution. But the focus being on the text is actually not a focus on specific people's intent, because mm-hmm. that actually starts right. to move us towards original intent. Originalism rather than a focus on the text. So we should actually look at the Federalist Papers for what it understands, what it helps us understand about the text. But we should look at other papers. I think your point might be that we shouldn't discount some of the Anti-Federalists and how they understood what the language would be, and or somehow the other secondary Federalists. Those are actually helpful right. to us in understanding the text. So. That's the one caveat that I would put about ranking the founders. Right. We should rank the founders historically, but we should remember that we are only looking at them in respect to a text when we are constitutional interpreters.
You're right. Yeah,
excellent.
You're right.
Before we get to the presentation of the Article I Award, please join me in giving a round.